I'll just start. Okay, so we've heard a lot about moments of L functions and the connection with random matrix theory, and so what I want to get to in my lecture is how we actually conjecture these very complicated looking moments that we claim contain all the main terms and have square root cancellation in it. But in order to do that, I need to describe to you what a family of L functions is, because it's a family of L function over which you take these moments. And not every collection of L functions is a family. And I'll attempt to describe our current understanding of what a family is. And all this that I'm going to talk about is in a paper joint with Brian Conry, John Keening, Mike Rubenstein, and Nina Snaith that we claim by the end of the month it'll be available. All right. So we're talking about L functions, and that means elements of the subgroup class. So Brian lent me some of his slides so that I didn't have to write them out myself. The first thing I want to focus on is the analytic properties of L functions as functions, meaning the functional equation. Because while originally we think of the characteristic polynomials as being a good thing because it has the same zeros as the zeta function or their statistical properties are the same, in fact, as functions, the characteristic polynomials and the L functions have this amazing correspondence of properties, and I want to first draw a little dictionary for you that matches everything up. So we need to match those properties, and so the first one I'll talk about is the functional equation. So characteristic polynomials of unitary matrices have a functional equation, and it's pretty easy to derive. So I'm using lambda for the characteristic polynomial because lambda is like L. So that's the determinant of identity minus X times my matrix, and I'm assuming this is a unitary matrix, and it's n by n. So since it's n by n, if I pull out a constant like x, I get an x to the n. And determinant of a times b is determinant of a, determinant of b. So if I pull out an a, I get determinant of a on the outside, and it becomes an a inverse on the inside. And I also pulled out this minus 1 to give me a minus 1 to the n there. So just definition or properties of determinants, this polynomial is this number times x to the n times this determinant. And now if I use the fact that a is unitary, a inverse is a conjugate transpose. And, well, by the definition of what I said for characteristics of the polynomial, that's the characteristics of the polynomial of the matrix a conjugate, but at the point 1 over x. Okay. So the functional equation is the polynomial of x is this constant, which has absolute value 1, times this function, times the polynomial for the conjugate matrix. Well, I also use the fact that the determinant of the transpose is the same as the determinant of the matrix at 1 over x. And this is supposed to look just like the functional equation for an L function. L of s is a number of absolute value 1 times some function times the conjugate L function at 1 minus s, but the functional equation now sends x to 1 over x instead of s goes to 1 minus s. Okay. And furthermore, there's some nice properties that these little parts of this functional equation have. And here's as much as I could put on one slide. All right, so your L function is defined like that. Your random matrix polynomial is defined like that. If you trace through the axioms of the subgroup class, the epsilon factor in this for the L function has absolute value 1. And that's also true for the epsilon factor minus 1 to the n determinant of A for the alpha, for the polynomial. This function has symmetry around the point 1/2. So when you plug 1/2 into that factor here, so epsilon is supposed to be the only thing that's telling you something about that special point from the functional equation. So this x factor shouldn't be telling you anything about the critical point. And if you check through that definition, it turns out you get one there. And that's true over here. So the x over here corresponds to x then here. And the symmetry of this functional equation is about the point 1. And when you plug in 1 into that factor, you get out 1. And furthermore, you expect all the zeros over here to be on the half line, while over here you know they're on the unit circle. And on the half line, your x factor is 1 in absolute value. It's that thing that's just spinning around quickly. And over here, on the critical line, better known as the unit circle, the x factor has absolute value 1 also. Now, the zeta function, or the L function, they're sort of, the nice half plane is to the right of the critical strip. And so it's not obvious unless you, well, until you do check something as to should that be the inside or the outside of the unit circle. And the way I think of it is L functions go to 1 as you go out to plus infinity, and characteristic polynomials go to 1 as you go into the origin. So it's the right half plane that corresponds to the inside of the unit circle. And, well, think of what's your favorite function that maps the right half plane inside the unit circle. E to the x does that. E to the minus x. So when we try to match up analytic properties of L functions with analytic properties of characteristic polynomials, we have to compare a point to the right of a half, L of a half plus x, with the polynomial at e to the minus x, where e to the minus x, I just got that because that's what mapped this half plane into there. Okay. And the final little thing is several people have mentioned that when we match up the mean values you get with the L function and the characteristic of the polynomial, we have to match the size of the matrix to something that's telling us the size of the L function. And John talked about matching the zero spacing. An equivalent way of thinking about it is matching the conductor, where we call the derivative of this x factor at a half the conductor, and that's supposed to match with the conductor of the polynomial, which the derivative of x to the n at 1 is n. And if you just check for things like the zeta function, this is log t over 2 pi matching up with n. Now, by the argument principle, that's identical to matching up zero spacing, but I think it's sort of nicer to think about it in terms of conductor. And also, I really should have written x prime over x at a half, but x at a half is 1, so I just left it off. Now, when we find these moments of
the
when we get to families of L functions, the conductor will order the family, and that's telling us how to average over it. Or the family might be finite, in which case they're also to have the same conductor, and they should match up with the appropriate size for random matrices.
So this suggests that there is the idea of neighborhood different elements.
Neighborhood?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. You mean telling if two L functions are close to each other? Yes, as long as all of the data, it's really the data in the Selberg class definition that has to be close. You could have two L functions with the same conductor, yet one of them has large conductor because Q is large, and the other one has Q is small and W is large, and I don't think those would come out. So I think it's really it's this data that's telling you if two L functions are close, and as a consequence, the conductor will be close. I don't think the conductor by itself, and not in full generality anyway. All right, so when we compute moments, we're not actually going to compute the L function moments, we're going to compute the Z function, meaning the real version of the L function. I can't remember if this was mentioned in a previous talk or not, but by the functional equation, the function commonly, well, which we call Z sub L of S, which you take the minus a half power of the epsilon factor and the chi function, that's going to be real on the half line. And you just check that, it comes out from the functional equation. And since the on the half line, this factor is absolute value 1, this is a function that's real on the half line, and it's either plus or minus the absolute value of the L function. So like the zeta function is sort of going all over the place, and this sort of rotates it around to be a real function that just has zeros at the same place as the zeta function. And that's the function we're going to, in the formulas, I'll show you the mean values of. And to make a connection with my previous talk, the information I gave you there is sufficient to compute the mean first power, not absolute value, of the z function and its mod square. And if you do that, you'll have proven that the zeta function has infinitely many zeros on the half line. And if you remember, the integral 0 to t of the zeta function by itself, that was asymptotic to t. And when you compute this, you will or will not also get t. And you should think about, should you have expected to get the answer you got? If you get t, this is t log t. And so that should tell you there's infinitely many zeros. But that's not telling you you get t. You need to do it and then decide if it made sense. All right, and for the, since there's a functional equation for the polynomials, in exactly the same way, we define the real version of the polynomial. And this time, it's real in the unit circle for all the same reasons as the other thing was. All right, and now I'm ready to tell you about the definition of a family of L functions. We don't claim that everything that deserves to be a family falls under the definition I'm going to give. Okay? What we claim is the axioms we give are sufficient to conjecture a mean value over the family, and that mean value will have an identical shape to a corresponding mean value of characteristic polynomials averaged over some group of matrices. Okay? Now, you may have a set of L functions over which you can compute a mean value, and it doesn't fall into this, and then maybe the answer doesn't look like what random matrix theory has been conjecturing. And that would be good, because that would induce random matrix people to figure out how can they model that family. So all we're trying to capture in the definition of family I'm going to give is those things which currently are modeled by random matrix theory. All right. And I have to warn you, the definition is long. Slide 1 of the definition. Your family of L functions has to contain L functions, meaning things in the subword class. Okay. So let's say you wanted to study all Dirichlet L functions, LS chi, for all characters. Well, Roger told you that if chi is not primitive, then that's not really an L function, meaning it doesn't have these properties. So you can't study the set of all Dirichlet L functions by these methods, but you could study all those for primitive characters. All right? F is going to index my family, so each thing in it has data from the subword class. There's a QF, these W things and U's, and there's an epsilon factor depending upon F. If the set F is finite, all those things have to be the same. Okay? So they all have to have the same conductor and degree, and these mu's have to be the same, and they all would have to have the same sign in their functional equation. So that's if F is finite. Okay? And if you have a finite set and it has, well, half the epsilons are plus and half the epsilons are minus, well, then you have two families. So just split them apart and do them separately and then put them back together if you want to. If the set of things indexing it are infinite, then these parameters here have to be monotonic functions of the conductor. Okay? So they can't all be jumping around. So, for example, if you remember, when Roger wrote down the functional equation for Dirichlet functions, there was this factor, gamma of s over 2 plus a, where a was 0 or 1, depending upon if the character were even or odd. So you can't study a family where a is half the time 1, half the time minus 1. You're going to have to pick either the even characters or the odd characters. And if you kid about them all together, you just do them separately and put them back together. So there's no restriction in studying anything you want. You're just going to have to do several calculations. All right. This epsilon factor, either it's the same for all the f's, or it's half the time plus 1 minus 1, or it's uniformly distributed on the unit circle. Okay. All right. Now we sort of change gears for the rest of the conditions.
The family of all functions has to...
Yes? Right, so for example, again for the Dirichlet functions, there was this Gauss sum. Sign in the functional equation, and that's a number of absolute value 1 that's sort of uniformly distributed as the conductor varies. And for the Riemann zeta function, like if your family's indexed by height up the critical line, then you have sort of a chi of it that's sort of spinning around too. Okay. So what I've written here is if the signs are both 1 and minus 1, the expected value of the sign has to be 0. In other words, half 1, half minus 1. And if I understand what I mean by uniformly distributed, then in this case, the expected value of that would also be 0 as you average over the family. All right. Now, your functions have to arise as the Rankine-Sellberg convolution of one fixed L function times a family of other L functions. It looks like a recursive definition, but it's not. So you have to have one collection of L functions which are going to twist a fixed L function to give you your family. Okay? And Brian briefly talked about Rankine-Sellberg convolution. It's enough to think of the case if these both have degree 1, meaning they're Riemann zeta function, Dirichlet function, then you twist by just multiplying the coefficients. So it's efficient if you think about I have coefficients in my L function, one of which is fixed and the other one of which is changing with my family.
If you don't like that, that's okay. Because if this L is the Riemann zeta function, all the A's are 1,
and that's degree 1, and this is just Bn. So this thing is a family by itself. Okay? So, but this is going to be a special kind of family because on the next slide is the conditions that this set of L functions has to satisfy. Okay? And that's it. It's only one more slide. We're going to be computing mean values of these L functions. And that means averaging them in some way. So we're going to have to average over these L functions, and meaning compute their expected value. And the way in which we compute that expected value is why there are these conditions on this twisting set of L functions. So the condition on this thing you're twisting by, and if you want to think of, you know, this is your family all by itself, that would be okay. You have an L function, meaning it's in the Sellberg class, and it has coefficients like this. So F is what indexes my family. These angle brackets mean expected value. The expected value of a product of F's at various integers times their conjugate at various other integers. That expected value has to exist, meaning you have to be able to average products of coefficients over your family of things you're twisting by. And furthermore, that thing that exists has to be a multiplicative function, meaning if you have two sets of numbers that have no factors in common, averaging these things at the products of these products is just the one of them times the other. This is a fundamental property that's required for our recipe to later conjecture the mean value. Okay. And here's where you see the number theory. If you take this averaged thing that's detecting these expected values and just sum it over all integers, it factors as an Euler product exactly because of this multiplicative property in ways like this. So not only is this thing going to need to exist and be multiplicative, if you expect to get an answer at the end for what are these mean values, you're going to need to know this function, at least on the prime powers, so that you can recognize this as something that you could go and compute. Okay? So let me give you some examples of this condition, and you'll see it's not, scary. And then I'll tell you how we use these axioms to give a recipe for conjecturing the mean value. So for what I'm doing now, I need a set of L functions with an index such that I can compute this kind of average. Okay? Take the Riemann zeta function and make the index be y, so y is any real number. And so I'm going to let my twisting L function, index by y, be zeta of s plus iy. Y has to be real. And, if you write it out, that equals this. And so my function y of n is n to the minus iy. And it's products of these that I need to be able to compute their expected value. So by definition, I'm computing the expected value of y at these places times the conjugate. And then that just means n to the minus iy, and then n to the plus iy's. And just by algebra, that's these n's over that n's all to the iy. And now you have to ask yourself, what's the expected value of that quantity? Well, if the top and bottom are equal, it's 1 to the iy, which is 1, and the expected value is 1. And if they're not equal, it's something to the iy, and you're averaging over y, and your expected value, that's 0. Okay, so this is definitely, there's a well-defined expected value for this product, and it's either 1 or 0. And if you just write out what the definition of multiplicative said, this condition, 1 when that equals that, is exactly, gives you a multiplicative function. Because you have to break up two things to separately be equal, and that's going to be okay if their primes don't have anything in common with each other. Another example is, let's say you take your family to be the Dirichlet functions for real characters, chi d, for d fundamental discriminant, and let's say d is congruent to a mod n, for whatever your favorite a and n are. So now you need to look at the expected value of this product of characters, and that's just the expected value of the character at that product, because this is a completely multiplicative function. And remember, chi d of n, it's 1 when n's a square mod d and 0 otherwise. So how could this thing be not 0? Well, it could be not 0 as you're averaging over d if this thing is a square mod d for every d, and that's pretty much true only if d is a square. There's a little fiddly bit because the fact that you're restricting d to be something mod n means there can be some other factors, but pretty much you get something non-zero when this thing here is a square, and otherwise you get 0. And the property of this being a square, if you check it out, that's also a multiplicative condition. And now, computing what this value is here is non-trivial. Mike Rubenstein did it, and I couldn't have. There can be really non-trivial number theory just in doing this when we're merely doing complete heuristics for the whole thing. So you don't miss out your chance to do some hard calculations, even when you're just conjecturing these things. All right. Oh, A set of L functions people care about is the one that goes with all elliptic curves. So, for example, Brian talked about Matt Young's work, where he found averages over the set of L functions matching with elliptic curves, y squared is x cubed plus ax plus b, for various collections of a and b. Like, a might be all the integers and b is the squares, or maybe they're both over all the integers. And, well, it's natural to ask, is that a family by this definition? And, well, our family is going to be ordered by conductor, and there's a non-trivial relation between the conductor of the curve and this a and b, but as a and b grow, the conductor kind of grows in, I think, a regular enough way that that part's okay, meaning you can average over it. And for any reasonable set of a and b, this sort of average of the coefficients of the L function, I mean, that exists because you can, the value of this only depends upon this a and b mod these integers. And so you could, you know, the thing exists. And I think it's obviously multiplicative, but I'd like if someone could explain to me why it is. And I don't know if it's easy or hard to compute that, because just because you know it's a family doesn't mean you can compute anything about it if you don't actually know what this, you know, delta function is.
You have the definition of the backup in the second slide where you compare quantities for L function and
yes.
So if you put in that definition of the backup, it was something like x, right? What do you get here?
That would be the law. Okay. The definition of conductor I gave, it's a monotonic function of what you would think of as conductor in all the cases you know, and it's usually approximately the log of the conductor. So for your set function, it's a log cube.
Yes, that is a log of the conductor.
Log of the usual conductor, where conductor already makes sense. Okay,
I called it the analytic conductor, I think. So the analytic conductor of this L function is about the log of the conductor of the elliptic curve. But you're averaging, and it's merely helping you to order the set. So the fact that it's log of it isn't changing the order. All right. Oh. So Brian actually mentioned a bunch of the ingredients to computing some of these expected values. So there's always some basic orthogonality relation that these things you're twisting by have that you can recover them. So for example, the first example I gave, I mean, you can recover what I wrote down just from this, you know, like two-variable case. And, you know, so for example, families of cusp forms, there's these, you know, more sophisticated kinds of, you know, formulas that you have. But, you know, if you're taking expected value, well, you know, only this term should draw your attention. It's, you know, it's 1 when m equals n and 0 otherwise, and all the rest is going away. So the expected value sort of washes out most of the hard part in the analytic calculation. Okay. Let me show you the recipe for computing, for conjecturing mean values when you have a family. In my first lecture, I talked about using approximate functional equations to compute mean values. And I used the approximate functional equation for zeta to compute the mod square of zeta. And then somebody asked me, well, when you're doing the fourth moment of zeta, do you just do the fourth moment of the approximate functional equation for zeta? And I said, no, it's not good to do that. You should take the approximate functional equation for zeta squared and then square that. Okay. But now I'm going to tell you, no, you should have used the approximate functional equation for zeta and taken a high power of it, because that's the main ingredient in our recipe. Okay? And the reason why I'm not contradicting myself, previous time I was talking about attempting to prove rigorously what the mean value is with an error term, and now I'm telling you how to conjecture it by a method which we know is has multiple incorrect steps in it, but those incorrect steps magically cancel each other. Okay? So, you have an L function product that you want to mean value. And I should have written Z here because I told you we were going to do Z, but I forgot. Okay? So think of these as Zs, but since Z is just a square root of chi thing times L, if I had written Z here, so that's your product. The first thing you do is replace all of these by their approximate functional equation and ignore the error term remainder part. Okay? So if I had written z here, there would be an epsilon to the minus a half chi to the minus half here. This would become epsilon to the half chi to the half because it's just a factor of that, you know, thing to the minus a half that you multiply in. So you take your product of L functions, replace them all by their approximate functional equation. So there's k things here. You're replacing each thing by a sum of two things. So you multiply them all out, and there's 2 to the k terms. Okay? And those 2 to the k terms, we need to do something to them to get our answer. And what do they look like? There's a product of epsilon factors, a product of chi factors, and a product of these, you know, of sums, which is just one big multiple sum of some sum end. That's what each of the 2 to the k terms looks like. So the first step is look at this product of epsilon factors you have here and replace it by its expected value. If all the epsilons are the same, well, then they're the same. That's its expected value. Let's say epsilon is equally often plus 1 and minus 1. Well, if this product of epsilons there is epsilon to the fourth, well, then its expected value is 1. And if it's an epsilon cubed, then its expected value is 0. So if epsilon is equal to often plus or minus 1, you've just lost half your terms at this step because for those, the product of epsilons has 0 expected value. All right. Then, in this sum and, now this sum and is a sum of products of ans and an conjugates, which our axiom said has an expected value. So you replace it by that. So the reason I need this expected value of is the next step in the recipe is you replace this sum and by its expected value, which exists and is multiplicative by an axiom. Okay. Now, I didn't tell you what the index of summation range was on here. Okay. And I made a big deal about that last time because if it was bigger than t, we're kind of stuck. If it's less than t, everything's easy. But I didn't tell you because it doesn't matter because the last step is take those terms. So you've only saved some of the terms when you replace the sum n by its expected value. That's some nice formula. Extend the sum to infinity. And the conjecture is the resulting thing you have, which is a sum of a bunch of terms, has the same expected value as the L function. Okay. So this final thing, which is this ugly sum of a bunch of terms of infinite sums of these delta functions, the conjecture is the expected value of it is the same as the expected value of the L function, meaning integrate it against some test function and you get the same answer. Now, because I said it has to be a multiplicative function, you can express this answer in a nice form, but it takes some work. Okay. Now, many times this week, people have told you that a certain family has a certain symmetry type. Here's Brian's list of various things. Well, how do you know what the symmetry type is of a family? Sometimes you can guess and sometimes you can't. So if you recall back what happened for the... If you recall what I wrote down about the functional equation for the characteristic polynomials, it looked like minus 1 to the n determinant of A. If A is running over all unitary matrices, this factor is uniformly distributed on the unit circle, and that means so that's for unitary matrices. In all of these cases, the epsilon factor in the functional equation is uniformly distributed in the unit circle, so you know that that's a unitary family. If this is an orthogonal matrix in SON 2n or 2n plus 1, then the determinant's either plus or minus 1. So if your family has determinant plus or minus 1. You know it matches with orthogonal. But there's no simple answer to just to identify all cases of what the symmetry type is. Because if your functional equation is always plus 1, then it could be orthogonal with plus a functional equation, or it could be symplectic. And I think that we should stop looking for a simple explanation of which how to resolve those things. Because Katz and Czarnecki have to compute some monodromy group of their family, and that tells them the symmetry type. So we shouldn't expect it to be easier to determine symmetry type in the case of these kind of L functions, because these are harder to understand. So it's unreasonable to expect to tell you what kind of symmetry type your family has without doing a calculation, possibly a very serious calculation. One way to do it is you go through this procedure and find the expected value of your family, moments of it, and compare that to the known expected values of moments for characteristic polynomials, and what formula does it match. We claim that these axioms I've given will make it match one of them, and that's how you can tell your symmetry type.
Okay. All right, so let me show you.
I mean, how do they determine the symmetry type of their family? So, I mean, they're studying function field L functions, and a set of those has something called monodromy associated to it, which is some kind of group, and that group tells you the symmetry type of the family. And I'm just repeating words I've heard other people say. I don't know what they mean. And no one knows an analog of monodromy for these kind of L functions. Okay. All right. So what we've done is implemented this recipe for many families of L functions and also computed the analogous quantities for families for characteristic polynomials over these various groups of matrices. Okay? So for unitary, orthogonal, symplectic, we have conjectures and theorems, and one reason why we believe the conjectures is they look just like the theorems up to obvious changes that have to be made. So what I want to show you is one of those pairs of conjecture and theorem where this recipe was implemented for moments of an arbitrary L function. So you take any L function in the Sauber class and look at L a half plus IT to the 2K. Okay. So it's any L function, that's going to be unitary family indexed by T. And we have what that equals. And we also know what the averages of the characteristic polynomials to the 2K are. And I'm going to show you both of them on one slide. And don't panic, because we're going to spend a long time looking at this slide until everybody has absorbed the whole thing. Okay? So the theorem is what's below the setup is at the top, and the formula is at the bottom. So there is a conjecture and a theorem being stated simultaneously. The conjecture, which is everything in green, is about the z function of a primitive L function. Okay, and the theorem is about the z version of the characteristic polynomial of a unitary matrix. And what we're going to talk about is averages of those. Okay? Now, what does average mean? For the L function, it means integrate it 0 to t against some test function and divide by what that test function gives you. And it's okay to make the test function be the characteristic function of the interval 0 to t. So you can just integrate 0 to t. Okay? So that's what average means. Now, let's look at the formula. This expected value has these factors out front. It's a multiple contour integral around little circles around the origin. It involves the van der Waal squared. It involves this product of these little W's minus these alphas. Oh, an important thing I should have said at the beginning. We're looking at the L function shifted away from the critical point, or the characteristic of the polynomial shifted away from its critical point. If you really wanted to study just this moment on the half line, you'd never discover the structure that these things have in common, because you sort of lost all the information when you specialized on the critical line. So what I'm really evaluating is not this, but the integral 0 to t of L at a half plus a1 plus it product down to L of a half plus a2k plus minus it. So there's all these shifts in it. So my mean value is a function of 2k variables. And as a function of 2k variables, the L function and the characteristics of the polynomial thing are what are going to match up. So those little shifts are occurring down here. Okay. So where do these two functions differ? The conductor occurs here. So for the zeta function, that's log t over 2 pi. For this more general L function in the subword class, it looks like this. But for the characteristic of the polynomial, it's just n. Okay. And the only other place where things differ is this function g of w1 through w2k. For the L function, it's an arithmetic thing, which I wrote it out there for you in case you care, and times this product of zeta functions. And for the characteristic of the polynomial, it's this thing with e's. And these have similar properties in that the zeta function has a simple pole at 1. When zi is zj plus k, that zeta at 1, which is a pole. So this has a pole when zi is zj plus k. And when zi is zj plus k, it's e to the 0, which is 1. 1 minus 1 is 0. 1 over 0 is infinity. So this also has a simple pole. So both functions have simple poles at where these variables all match up. And all of the arithmetic information is in this A and this zeta function around there. So you need some arithmetic information somewhere. That's where it appears. And so this is it when we have all these different A's. And you can let all the A's go to 0. And you recover the mean 2k power of your L function. And you exactly get the previous conjectures for all these moments. So for the sixth moment of zeta, you get your 42 and your A3. So you have to check that this A function, when you plug in all zeros for it, you get the AK that I derived from you for you on that on my previous talk. Okay? So this recipe produces this recipe agrees with every known moment of every alpha function family that's ever been computed. So maybe there's 20 of them, and this gives the right answer every time. Okay. And also agrees with all previous conjectures. Have I said enough about this slide? Okay. The usual way I would give this talk is I write on one transparency the zeta function case, and the other one, the re-under matrix thing. And you keep looking back and forth and verifying that it's all the same. So someone should let me know if I should go back to that method, because I came up with this when I was very late last night. All right. Now, furthermore, these conjectures imply all of the known random matrix conjectures, meaning this recipe will tell you the paracorrelation function of the zeros, or the neighbor spacing, or whatever. And here's the way it works. What I've called the prehistoric version, Steve alluded to a conjecture I made a long time ago about this mean value of ratios of zeta functions. So you put two zetas over two zetas. Can anybody see the typo? This should be a minus. Okay. That equals this nice simple thing. So there's no AK, no arithmetic, anything. Now, I didn't have wonderful reasons for making this conjecture, but it satisfied, had so many nice properties, I felt that it had to be true.
So, for example,
that is going from A to
T. So, I'm integrating 0 to T. So, these A's need to be pretty small, like around 1 over log T. So, as you do mean value of 0 to T, it's asymptotic to this expression here, which is just, if A and B are about 1 over log T, it's pretty much just a constant. Okay. So I mentioned in my previous talk that Goldstein, Gonick, and Montgomery evaluated the mod square of zeta of Hapless Apis IT as this paracorrelation function. So that means if you knew a formula for this, you'd know a formula for the paracorrelation function. So you can produce the mod square of zeta Hapless Apis IT from this formula here, and you can do it in about, I don't know, four ways or something. So you could differentiate with respect to A and B, and then set A, B, C, D all equal to each other. And that would give you this. Or you could differentiate with respect to C and D, and set A, B, C, D all equal to each other, and you'd get this. And there's other ways to do it. And they all give the same answer. And that's just too good to be true. I mean, I couldn't have invented a function with that property if I tried. I just sort of stumbled across it and think, well, that can't be a coincidence. And the answer you get is this. And if you invert this Laplace transform, that exactly implies that the f function looks like what Montgomery's conjecture is, like that. Okay. So this mean value implies the paracorrelation conjecture. And the only difference between this mean value and what I've been showing you in the recipe, I mean, they both have all these shifts, is that there's denominators here. But the recipe works in that case, too. You just need an approximate equation for 1 over a zeta function, which is just another Dirichlet polynomial. And when you carry out that whole process, what you find is a somewhat more complicated formula. So the recipe can't give something nice and simple like this. It gives all stuff involving zeta functions and arithmetical stuff. And what it gives is this. But, what is zeta 1 plus AB, this thing, look like when A, B, C, D are all small? Well, there's a pole at 1. So zeta 1 plus A plus B is like 1 over A plus B. So this is A plus C, B plus D over A plus B, C plus D, which is written, well, it's there if you rearrange things. And there's these other arithmetic parts. And we haven't checked this yet, but it's got to be true that if you take this version and apply Goldstein, Gonick, and Montgomery's formula to it, you'll recover a formula for the paracorrelation function that has these lower order arithmetic corrections to it, which should be the same as what Bogomolny and Keating get from the twin prime conjectures. And more generally, we believe that you can compute, larger ratios and get the higher order correlations, also including these lower order terms. But we haven't actually, written out the formulas for that. Okay. So, let me end by putting this slide back up again. So, I guess I'd like you to just take away not what this thing looks like, but just the fact that we have a theorem for the moments of characters of polynomials, which is exact, and it matches up with a very arithmetic way of producing a conjecture for the moments of L functions, which gives the exact same formula, which we believe has all the main terms in it. And I think this is pretty convincing evidence that all these answers have to be correct. Thank you.
Questions? So far, we've talked about this moments on the half line. I know some people will ask results of moments on the long line as well. How do those relate?
Right. This formula, this vector probably is wrong if you say let A equal a half and B equal a half to try to get something on the one line. But this one that has all these extra weight factors, I bet that it gives you the right answer. So you can let, would you agree with that, Brian? You could let A and B and stuff like that equal a half, and then this will give you the right answer on one.
Correct. Follows. Yeah. Doing that, but I would just say the moments on the one line are easy.
Yeah, but you know, like three quarters line.
Well, they're easier than moments.
Yeah, so I think an unhelpful answer is all those other moments are easier. So
I didn't soar all the way up, all the way through the groups, but when you get to the line, you're going to have problems in that eight factor. Because if it takes C as a negative half, then you're in grading. Now maybe it's in regular one line. What else you need to nominate on? Right? In that eight factor, one line of half.
Yeah,
so you're going to run into some problems. For the one line, but inside the code, it should work fine.
Right. So this, I think Chris, you talked about that idea that you look at where your answer is valid, and that's where your answer makes sense, and that's where you should think it's true. So this answer makes sense in a critical strip, but not in one bound. So perhaps this connection is true in a critical strip, and you have to do something different on the one line. But then you really are pretty close to the end. Everything matches up. There is no modular forms are what give you offers. The offers just come from that. So, a simple but probably not helpful answer is: well, where do the characteristic polynomials of matrices come? So maybe in some sense the matrix is a modular form. Or if not, there's going to be something else there. I can't think of a more deep answer than that. But I think it's a really good question.
There are no other questions. Together again.